recognizes the proper relationship between academic growth and the industrial community. I have expressed my views in the paper, which you all have, but I'm sure that some of you have not read it, and even for those who have, perhaps it would be worthwhile if I should emphasize some of the points. So really, I shall be really giving a condensation or a special emphasis to certain points that I have made in this paper. A part of the rationale of the free enterprise system, I take it to be a part of the defense of the free enterprise system, has been the functioning of that system in the allocation of resources. It has been assumed that when owners control their own property, their own capital, they will go around through the country, as I've said, sniffing around to find the most profitable uses for their funds. And then we make the further step in reasoning that the most profitable uses under a system of competition will be the most productive uses. And thus we could argue that under a system of private ownership, private capitalism, we have millions of individuals trying to use their own money in a way that will make it most productive. This is elementary, of course, as a part of the defense of the free enterprise system. There was an additional point that the owners would commonly supervise the use of their capital, and that owners would always be more concerned with and would be more effective in controlling their capital than hired men would be. This was, in a way, a satisfying sort of rationale, and to some extent it still continues unimpaired, particularly in the case of small business, medium-sized business, and various other places in the community. But as far as the large corporations are concerned, there are a number of things that have happened that tend to impair this picture. I don't mean to say that it impairs the final conclusion to the picture, but the rationale becomes somewhat blurred. One of these is that the owners no longer really control a large corporation. This is a pretty broad statement, and there are many exceptions to it, I realize. But as to the typical large corporation in the United States, a concern like the General Motors Corporation or American Telephone and Telegraph Company, it is quite clear that the owners do not really control those corporations. There are several reasons for this, and that the people who do control it are the professional managers. There are several reasons for this. In the first place, widespread ownership. It is it's rather ironical that a number of the people who are the critics of the of large business today, and on this very point that I am speaking of, are the people who would applaud the coming of a people's capitalism. And that's what we have had, that you have millions and millions of people owning these large corporations. In the case of General Motors, there are more stockholders in General Motors than there are workers. Some 500,000 or so workers in General Motors Corporation, there are more stockholders. The old picture of a few bloated capitalists employing thousands and thousands of workers is quite inaccurate today. The number of owners is greater than the number of the workers. And in the case of American Telephone and Telegraph Company, it's even more strikingly true, in which there's some 2 million stockholders. And a further characteristic is that in both of these cases, no one individual owns as much as 0.5% of the respective corporation. There is no great wealthy person then who can really, through his power of ownership, who can really control either of those organizations or very materially affect the policies or direction of the of these organizations. In the case, some of you will be thinking of this, that in the case of General Motors, some 23% of the stock of General Motors was, should I say was or is, I have to look at the calendar, owned by the DuPont Company. And the DuPont, and this did represent a nucleus of ownership by another corporation. But that does not contradict the statement I've just made that there's no individual who owned any considerable proportion, because the DuPont Company in turn has this widespread ownership as well. But as you know, as many of you know, by result of a recent legal decision, the DuPont Company is required now to divest itself of its shares in General Motors, which means that in the case of General Motors, there will no longer be even a nucleus of ownership around which other people could, around which other owners could rally. And I need hardly say that among these many owners, there's tremendous variety of these owners. There are, some of them are rather wealthy people, and some of them, on the other hand, are retired school teachers, and so on. And so it comes about to this, that it would be impossible, even if the managers, even if the professional managers were striving their very best to serve the interests of the stockholders, it would be impossible to do so, because there is no stockholder. There is no typical stockholder. Here's on the one side is a man like Mr. Mott, who is a very wealthy man, the largest stockholder in General Motors. The last thing in the world he wants is dividends, because these are going to be taxed at ordinary rates, for example, and he would much rather have the money plowed back into the company. Here's the little school teacher, or retired school teacher, who on the other hand is depending upon the income from her stock as for current living expenses. And between these are all sorts of kinds and types of varieties of owners. There is no such thing as the typical stockholder. Well, there are a number of other changes that have come. I only have time to take time here to mention two or three of them. One of them is that aside from this matter of ownership, one of them is that the corporation no longer confines itself to a rather specific set of objectives. The original concept of the corporation is that here was a few wealthy people who got together and they used this type of organization combine their capital resources and to perform some particular thing. Going to make mouse traps and make some money, or going into the shipping business and make some money. So this, I think, is no longer really true. The large corporation does not think of itself as a producer of a particular thing. It thinks of itself as a continuing organization. And one thing that they're producing runs out, well, they just start in producing something else. There are a number of interesting examples of that. A certain gold mining company in California, for example, which is entirely different kinds of business now, has anything to do with gold mining. The same corporation goes on. The continuing thing, in other words, has become the corporation, the institution itself. Whereas previously it might have been thought that the permanent thing was the owners, and the corporation was a temporary device used to accomplish certain specific purposes. Today, the permanent thing becomes the corporation. The transient element are the owners. And the corporation, the main characteristic of this corporation is that it is a team, an organization well adapted to accomplish things. And that's about as plainly as you can put it. What is the General Motors Corporation? General Motors Corporation is an extremely efficient organization, well designed for accomplishing desired things. It happens that today what they're doing is making automobiles. If they were not making automobiles, I'm quite sure they could make airplanes. They could make railroad cars. They could make one thing or another. The significant thing has ceased to be the particular product which the organization is working upon, and has come to be the significant thing is the team that you have, the organization, in other words, an institution. The corporation thus has become sort of an independent institution, independent in a way of the stockholders, independent of various other people in the community. It is an institution in its own right, an institution which has purposes and objectives of its own. What are these purposes and objectives? Well, I should say that this institution very much like a biological organism. The main objectives are survival and growth. This very readily translates in the case of the corporation into solvency and economic expansion. These are the two things which do seem to be the most powerful, motivating forces, especially among American corporations. Solvency, of course, that has to be taken for granted. Expansion.
Expansion for its own sake.
Now, this raises the question, then. Some people have raised this question, whether this institution can be allowed to control itself or whether it should have some government control. A. Burley, for example, in his book on Power Without Property, as well as in the earlier book of some 20-odd years ago, The Modern Corporation, rather suggests that all of this sort of development in which the managers, he says, and others have said, have the pleasure of playing with other people's money, that they ought to be subjected to government control. And also, the argument is made that we've sort of lost sight of the profit motive. As to the second point, let me take that one first. The second point, I do not think that it's true that the profit motive has receded in the background. I think it is true that in the minds of the managers of the large corporations, they are not motivated primarily and directly and consciously by the desire to earn the largest rate of return for the stockholders. No. I think what they are motivated by is the desire to advance the interest of the corporation as an institution, as a separate thing. But to advance the interest of the corporation under a system of private capitalism, and this is the distinction between private capitalism and public ownership and common government ownership, to advance the interest of the corporation requires the making of profits. Let me put it in this way. I asked a few years ago, I was giving a talk to a group of executives in American Telephone Telegraph Company, and rather to pull their leg, I said, well, not really, after all, what is the difference between you fellows and the post office? You're all salaried people. The company is run by salaried men. The owners have very little control over this thing. You have 2 million stockholders. Post office, in a way, has, I might say, 50 million or 100 million, whatever you want to think of it. What really is the difference? This rather stumped some of them, but one of them came up with a very intelligent answer. That, and I had also made the point that you really are not so much concerned with paying larger dividends to the stockholders. That's what you talk about. I doubt very much if that is. And he said, well, even admitting this last point, that there are certain things that we, the managers of AT&T, would like to do. Technological things. Each one has his own pet idea. We'd like to carry out this scheme or this scheme and so on. The fact is that the possibility of carrying out any of these things, any of these objectives, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company depends upon the earnings of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. And you can't say that for the post office. The post office receives its income as an appropriation from Congress. There is no necessary connection between the effectiveness and the earnings, the ability to produce something of value over the cost. There's no necessary connection between that and the power of the post office to do the things which the people in the post office organization would like to do. And so it seems to me that these objectives, the objective of expansion on the one side, solvency, objectives in a private property system do depend upon the existence of profits, and therefore the profit motive is just as important as it was before, although lying back of this is not necessarily the thought that the purpose of earning the profit is simply to increase the rate of dividend. There's coming to be a accepted idea in most American corporations, I think, that here is a certain standard rate of dividend. We have established a $2 rate, $2 dividend, let us say. We have a sort of an obligation to pay that, yes. Over and above that, there's the amount which can be plowed back into the corporation or which can be
passed out to the stock.
When I say that the managers are have an interest in plowing this back into the corporation because it makes their own organization bigger, and making the organization bigger makes them more important and so on. Does not imply that this is against the interest of the owners. Owners generally approve of this. How do I know that owners generally approve? Because if owners do not approve of this, they will sell the stock in this company. This brings me to another point. Of the various criticisms of this new development, particularly this ownership development, one of them is that the stockholder is deprived of his rights, deprived of his freedom of action.
Well, I think
nothing could be further from the truth. The freedom of action of the stockholder consists in the ability to dispose of this stock at a moment's notice. It does not. The stock, and this is one of the reasons for the so-called apathy of the stockholders. Stockholders do not very commonly attend stockholders' meetings. Why don't they attend stockholders? If you're disgruntled about the way your company is being run, why don't you get down there and talk about it? Well, there's no point in this. It's much simpler just to lift the telephone, and in 2 minutes you've sold this stock and bought another one that you did like. And so there is a constant process of selection going on among the investors in the country, and the owners of the managers of the corporation have to have this in mind, because none of them can view with equanimity the general tendency on the part of the stockholders to sell the stock of their company. This means decline in the value of the stock of the company, which would be undesirable from a number of points of view. On the very point that Mises mentioned of whether the American people are so stupid, this argument comes into levied at large business in particular, that the large businesses are in a position to foist almost any product upon the consumer that they want to do. This statement has even been made in the case of the automobile industry. Well, a most striking answer to this was the experience of the Edsel car a few years ago. Here was the second largest automobile company in the country, the third largest corporation in the United States, one of the largest corporations in the world, with billions of dollars behind it, thousands of people working on it from the point of view of advertising and public relations, market researching, trying to discover what the consumer's desires were and so on, and all of this went in for a period of 3 years. And out came the Edsel car, and it fell flat on its face, with a loss of millions of dollars. It seems to me there's a perfect answer. The fact that nobody, not even the largest of corporations, can sell to the American consumer something the American consumer doesn't want. And in this particular case, it was not because the product was technologically a poor product. The Edsel car, by the testimony of its competitors, the Edsel car was a very good car. It was just some slight little thing that the public didn't like about the design or something of the sort. The public is very fussy when competition is very keen. Yeah, just one word, finally, to sum up that part by saying that I think that while a number of changes have come, we have to recognize these in presenting our rationale or defense of a free market system, that the emergence of the corporation as a sort of an independent entity, having a life of its own, having objectives of its own, does fit in, it seems to me, this does fit into the previous rationale for the reason that the profit motive is still as strong as it was before, being directed in a somewhat different way. I'd like to add this other point, which is perhaps not too closely related, and that is that because of the efficiency of the large corporation, which Professor von Mises has emphasized, there has developed a great admiration in the United States for big business. You might not think so from the public pronouncements and propaganda and attack on large business. The fact is that we do have a sort of a split-mindedness in the United States about big business. It came out one day when I asked my secretary, I'd been dictating something about big business, and I said, "Betty, what do you think about big business?" And she said, "Well, I've heard everything you've said, but I don't like it. What don't you like about it?" "Well, they have too much power." "Power to do what?" "Oh, I don't know. Power to push little people around, I guess. I see. Betty, I don't know whether you've ever read Thomas Jefferson, but you're in good company in this view that you... let me stop and smoke a cigarette for a minute, and then came back and said, where do you buy your groceries, Betty? Well, the A&P store, of course. Well, the A&P store is the largest chain store and largest distributor of groceries in the United States. I said, I thought you said you didn't like them. No, I didn't say I didn't like A&P. I said, I didn't like big business. Well, A&P is big business. Well, why do you buy there? Well, of course, I get the best product there, and I get the low prices, and I get... It's good service, sure. I don't see any inconsistency between these two. Well, this is the general state of mind of the American people. We like the product of big business, at the same time we're a little afraid of it. We'll like the people of Siman, who love those elephants that have so much power to move things around, but they're always aware of the fact that the elephant might push their house over, too. The two sides of things. In general, I think, however, the statement is to justify that there is a great admiration, even though there might be fear at the same time. There's a great admiration for the abilities and the things that big business can do. And in this lies, perhaps I'm seeing ghosts where I should, maybe exaggerated. But it seems to me that in this very admiration lies a danger. A danger that we will think that you can turn over a great many problems to the large corporation, which really do not belong to corporations at all. That is the welfare programs, the pension plans. A few years ago, a man, during the time there was a strike gun at Ford, and the man, workman, was interviewed by the newspaper man. And he said, I want to consider myself as Ford's man, apostrophe S, Ford's man. They should be responsible for it, looking after me from the time I go to work to them to the death. Good Lord, if you would just change from Ford's man to Lord Bedford's man or Lord somebody else's man, you're back to feudalism, aren't you? This is exactly what this was. That he was asking that he should be owned by somebody. And this, I think, is a very dangerous thing. And there fighting it out right now in the strike and the negotiations going on between the automobile industry and the workers, right today, more and more of the so-called fringe benefits. In favor of the cash benefit instead of the fringe benefit is that cash benefits give you freedom and fringe benefits don't. So I think there is a danger here that out of the very success of the large corporation, it's not so much that the American people doubt the effectiveness of the large corporation, it may be that they exaggerate. They think the large corporation is well fitted to do almost anything. Even the government, you see, is coming to rely very heavily on some 20% of the revenues of the United States government comes from the corporation income tax. And notice this is not just a tax upon corporations, but upon the profits of corporations. The government is really in business, you see, with the large corporations. I think this becomes a rather dangerous thing. So I complain about these things not because they place onerous burdens upon the large corporations, but because there's great danger when when the community tries to make, puts themselves in a position where any one institution, especially a private institution, becomes indispensable to